Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 16th of August. Before we begin a very serious conversation, I do want to tell you that we have this really terrific special event on Lake Michigan, the jewel here in the southeastern part of the state of Wisconsin, and we want to tell you there's still time to make a reservation and join Joy Cardine, Gene Faraca, Ben Marins, and me for a special day at Discovery World Museum. It's taking place Sunday, August 26. You'll be treated to a private after-hours tour of the museum, which is brand new, a buffet dinner provided by Barlotta's Restaurants. They're very fine, and also a Lake Michigan cruise on the motor yacht Voyager. And there will be, of course, lots of time to talk to all of us, to the managers, to fellow listeners. It should be just a lovely day. But you need to make your reservations by the end of the day on Friday, tomorrow. So please call today to make your reservations for this wonderful gathering on beautiful Lake Michigan and Discovery World in Milwaukee. It's August 26, and the number for you to call is 414-227-2047, 414-227-2047. It should be a memorable day. Now on to some pretty serious issues. We'll be looking this hour of the program at the poor families in the Yazidi community hit by bombings in Iraq yesterday. And these tolls may go way up. A current toll of 250 people died, 350 people who have been injured there. It is one of the worst bombings in more than 4 years of war. We'll talk about who's responsible for attacking these kinds of communities. Also, we'll be looking this hour at labeling Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps as a foreign terrorist organization. The State Department is proposing that. The administration seems to be moving in that direction. We will discuss the Iraqi prime minister and the president announcing that there will be a new alliance of moderate Shiites and Kurds to save the crumbling government in Iraq. Sunnis, so far not in the equation here. What does that mean? And all of that is on the table this first hour of our program, so we have a whole lot to move through. Our guest is Professor Mary Habeck. Professor Habeck is an associate professor of strategic studies at Johns Hopkins University, and her most recent publication is Knowing the Enemy, Jihadist Ideology and the War on Terror. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Joining us in Milwaukee, the Milwaukee line is 414-227-2050. 414-227-2050. Professor Habeck, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start, because these pictures were just so dramatic, and this story of this very poor community, the Yazidi community, being hit by bombings, the worst in 4 years probably. Why is this area being targeted? And who's doing the bombing?
Yeah, this is such a huge tragedy for this community, which has always faced sort of second-class citizenship in this part of the world. Unfortunately, the Yazidis are a remnant community that is pre-Islamic and may even be pre-Christian.
Really?
They worship a god that is generally called the Peacock God, who is identified, at least by Islamic scholars, as being the same as Satan. So one of their names, or at least some Islamic scholars, so one of their names has been, at least by those who do not like this community, is the Satan worshippers. Of course, they deny this vehemently. And they have always been sort of the poorest of the poor in Iraq and Syria and other places where small remnants of this community exist. Really, the trouble, though, this sort of trouble has been unknown in this part of the world. The communities there have gotten along with each other fairly well throughout the past several hundred years. It's just that a few months ago, there was an incident that was used by the radicals amongst the jihadis in order to target the Yazidis especially. And what happened was there was a Yazidi girl who was courted by, and then there was, an attempt to marry her by a Muslim boy. And the result was that they decided to carry out an honor killing And I think the Muslim boy was also killed in the process of the Yazidi community attempting to prevent this marriage from being carried out.
Mm.
And so what happened was the jihadis declared a blood vengeance against the entire community.
Mm.
And there have been a series of attacks, much smaller ones than this, that have gone on over the past several months. And but this obviously was horrific, and was their ultimate aim, which is, as they put it in several publications, to wipe out the Yazidi community.
Mm. The United States military is blaming al-Qaeda for these bombings, saying that it fit the profile of spectacular strikes expected by the organization during the ongoing surge operation. What do you make of that?
Yeah, al-Qaeda were the ones who, in particular, al-Qaeda in Iraq and now the Islamic State of Iraq, which is kind of their cover name, were the ones who were most vehement in calling for vengeance against the Yazidi community as a whole, to punish them for these deaths. So I think that this is if they didn't carry it out personally, they were the ones who were inciting people to carry out. And they're right. This is precisely the kind of methodology they use: multiple bombings, trucks, filled with fuel. All those sorts of things are things that they've done in the past.
Right. You looked at the images on television last night of all these young children, people in shock, people horrendously injured, if not dead, and you throw your arms up and say, "Oh my gosh, how can this stop?"
Yeah. Well, you know, this is, I think that this sort of tension has fallen kind of outside the radar of most people. We know a little bit more now about the Sunni-Shia tension and the violence that has gone on between those two communities. But there are, in fact, several minority communities in Iraq that have also suffered terribly during the past several years. The Yazidis are one. The Turkomens have also been riven by a civil war in which Sunni Turkomens have been killing Shia Turkomen. And the Christian community has been attacked from all sides by both Sunnis and Shias. So this has been a pretty terrible time for all of the communities in Iraq.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's look at this attempt to create a government again, a crumbling government, an announcement that that there has been some kind of alliance here with moderate Shiites and with Kurds to save the government, but the Sunnis don't seem to be in the equation here. Is there any chance of forming some kind of new alliance that may restore some kind of order, Professor Habeck?
Yeah, my understanding is that the major block of Sunnis that left the government, the Tawafiq Front, left saying that they had a list of demands. They were not, leaving and saying, "That's it, we give up on the government," but rather, "You are not meeting any of our demands or compromising on these very important issues for us, and when you're willing to talk, we'll come back." So there has been a door left open for some sort of negotiations. Now, whether that'll happen or not is, of course, anybody's guess, and I think they do need outside pressure to come to any sort of agreement. The situation actually in Iraq very much reminds me of that inside Bosnia, where you have a minority community in Bosnia was the Serbians, who had basically been in charge for the past decades or however long it has been for Iraq, hundreds of years the Sunnis ran things. But they were a minority community, and they basically had to be brought to a negotiating table, not by some sort of internal dynamic, but by outside forces that wouldn't allow people to use simply violence to attain their end. So in the case of Bosnia, it wasn't just the United States, obviously. It was the UN. It was a lot of other NATO. It was a lot of other people that were pushing for this. And I think inside Iraq, it's going to take some sort of outside force to get people to realize that violence will not get them what they need, and that it'll only be at the negotiating table that they'll be able to find some sort of solution.
And what's the makeup of that outside force?
Well, that's the question. I mean, right now, the United States, with one or two allies, is the only force on the ground that's able to impose some sort of solution or attempt to impose some sort of solution. We all heard some very good news, though, over the last couple of weeks, and that is that the UN is reconsidering its decision to withdraw and is thinking about going back into some of the areas that have now been pacified. So I think that's a very positive step and is the sort of thing that could lead to a much broader settlement.
Mm-hmm. Tell me, we're getting a report from Petraeus in September about the success of the surge here. When you get news like you got yesterday about these horrendous bombings, how in the world can you have any kind of report that would say the surge is working? Because people wouldn't even believe it if that's what the report says. And what does that do for our strategy in Iraq?
Yeah, I don't want to minimize the tragedy that occurred amongst the Yazidi community. I've heard some people, in fact, call this attempted genocide. And given the language that's been used by al-Qaeda in talking about these people, I have to say that I agree. I think that they really do want to see them all dead. So I don't want to minimize what's going on there. But this is a teeny tiny minority community amongst the vast majority of Iraqis who are Sunni and Shia. And so you have to look, I think, at the rest of the country and say, what is going on in the rest of the country? And there have been some very positive developments. I'm not saying that, you know, everything's settled or even that we've won or mm-hmm. anything that extreme, but there have been some very positive developments that have the opportunity to create a very positive direction in the way that the war is going right now. Again, I'm not trying to say that, you know, everything's been settled, but if you look at the arrows, the way that the war is pointed right now, it is heading towards a good solution. Unlike, let's say, a year ago when all the arrows were pointed in the wrong direction and we were headed towards a very bad direction. So, for instance, Anbar province a year ago, which is a very large province and has been the center of the Sunni insurgency and of al-Qaeda support. In fact, this is what they were counting on sort of as their fallback strategy, just in case everything else went bad for them. Anbar province has been almost entirely, not completely, but almost entirely pacified. And the way it's been pacified has not been American pressure from without, although that has helped. We've kind of, believe it or not, become the honest brokers in the situation there. It's been an internal decision by the Sunnis that al-Qaeda and the other extremists are just not representing them and that they're hurting them more than they're helping them. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that kind of internal decision when people themselves turn against an insurgency is the beginning of the end of an insurgency. But, again, that's just the beginning of the end, and it's not certainly not anywhere near a final victory or win or anything like that.
Briefly to Iran and Iraq, and then we'll take some phone calls. The administration preparing to declare that Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps is a foreign terrorist organization. What does that mean for us?
Well, there are all sorts of things that can now be done in order to stop the forces that the U.S. government at least claims are operating inside Iraq. So, for instance, there's something called the Al-Quds Force, which means, by the way, basically the Jerusalem Force. It's an elite group of commandos, special forces, if you want to put it that way, who have been operating not just inside of Iraq, but also in Lebanon and other places around the world where Iran has interests. So they send off these special forces to get involved in the internal situations in other countries and to help arm, train, and so on, insurgencies that they support or communities that they happen to support inside these countries. So the U.S. government has claimed now for, I think, more than a year that the Al-Quds Force, which is part of this Iranian Revolutionary Guard, has been inside Iraq and is arming, training, and so on, and financing some of the insurgents. And, in fact, they're benefiting from the violence there. So this is an attempt, I think, by the administration to be able to cut off this financing by going after this particular group of troublemakers.
Mm-hmm. Is it a good strategy, in your opinion?
Well, you know, it does legally allow the U.S. government to do a few things that it couldn't do beforehand, for instance, to go after financing and stuff like that they perhaps could not do beforehand. So I think for the administration, this is, or for the war, just, you know, thinking outside the administration, if it can help in any way to cut off the financing and arming of some of these groups, that can only be a good thing. And also, you know, for the administration itself, which has been arguing for over a year as well, that Iran is interfering in the business of Iraq, This is another way for them to make that same point and to show that these are the guys who are linked up with these weapons that we're finding inside Iraq. I know that you've probably seen the news reports about these specially shaped charges that have been killing so many Americans. So I guess the argument that's going to be made by the administration is that, look, these guys are not just killing each other, but these weapons are being used by Iran to kill Americans.
Mm-hmm. What about the Times had a story yesterday about this, and it said that the declaration would signal a more confrontational turn in the administration's approach to Iran. There are some who are saying that it could be an indication that we're about to take on Iran militarily. And it's also the first time the U.S. has added the armed forces of any sovereign government to its list of terrorist organizations.
Yeah, there are all sorts of things about this that are unprecedented. Just thinking about the very first thing you brought up, many people have been saying, or there has at least been a movement, I don't want to say it's many people, but there is a movement that says we should be engaging Iran, not shunning them, and certainly not declaring them a pariah nation with whom we can have nothing to do. If you look at all the countries in that region, you know, who can we be talking to? We've put, you know, many countries sort of off, out of bounds, so therefore, you know, take a look at the Iraq Study Group's report back in December. This is one of the things they were arguing for as well, that we need to engage Iran, not shun them. And I think that this is a little bit disingenuous, because it's not as if the administration hasn't been reaching out to Iran and trying to figure out some way to work with them. My sense is that this is the result of frustration and an attempt to force the Iranians into some sort of negotiation by saying, we're not going to put up with this particular kind of activity, so you either come and talk to us or else we'll go after you. So this is, you know, kind of the stick, and there's probably a carrot being offered as well that's not being made as public.
Hmm. Oh, that's interesting. Welcoming phone calls, Professor Mary Habeck is our guest. She is Associate Professor of Strategic Studies at Johns Hopkins University and author of Knowing the Enemy, Jihadist Ideology and the War on Terror. We're talking about a number of issues this hour. We were just looking at Iran and labeling Iran's Revolutionary Guard as a foreign terrorist organization and what that means. We're looking at the horrendous bombings in the Yazidi villages, poor families where the attacks yesterday resulted in perhaps one of the worst death tolls, injury tolls in 4 years of war. And we're looking at an attempt by the Iraqi prime minister and the president to put together some kind of government, to save a government in Iraq. And also we have yet to talk about whether or not the surge is working. We have a little bit, but not fully. Well, we have a couple lines open if you'd like to join us. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you're in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. 414-227-2050. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
There's no...
Coming up the second hour of our program today, our guests are the founders of BuyChange.com, and they believe that the ultimate force for sustainable positive change is business, that we can intentionally use our dollars as consumers, and it can have an enormously wonderful effect on the world. So we'll be talking about that, and we'll talk with a gentleman who is known as Mr. Elipoo, Elephant Poo Paper, helping to make elephants more valuable alive and going to the bathroom, actually, than dead. It's a very interesting story. He has done work in Sri Lanka where humans and elephants have been killing each other. Part of the problem is this large elephant population declined by over 50%, and this is because people are moving into areas that have traditionally been inhabited by elephants as the population expands. So we'll talk with Mr. Elipoo, and we'll talk with the founders of BuyChange.com, and you can do a little bit to change the world with your money after you hear that show. All right, let's welcome phone calls. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. 227-2050 in Milwaukee. Our guest is Professor Mary Habeck, Associate Professor of Strategic Studies at Johns Hopkins University, author of Knowing the Enemy, Jihadist Ideology, and the War on Terror. And Rodney from Milwaukee is our first caller. Hi, Rodney.
Hi. I want to know how many more Iraqi people have to die before the Bush administration, not the rest of the world, but the Bush administration, call it success. I mean, those people over there are living a miserable life. Even if it ain't violence, it's no jobs, hardly, I mean, power and light is out. I mean, everything that possibly can go wrong is going wrong. I don't see any success, you know. I mean, the generals are disingenuous. The Bush administration is disingenuous. I mean, I can't see this going on anymore. And then I heard yesterday that they said, another general said, we're going to be there for at least another couple of decades. So, I mean, this really doesn't make any sense anymore. And for all these people to die and to say, oh, now we can call it a surge, a little bit of success, or that is not a success, I mean, anybody in their right mind should know this is over with.
Professor Habeck.
Yeah, I think there's probably two questions that are in your statement, and I really appreciate that. I think the first one is, how in the world do we even define success in this kind of war? And the second one is, shouldn't we just leave? Aren't we the ones who are really causing the problems over there? I mean, I think there's a real sense in America this is such a huge mess. Everything has gone wrong that can possibly go wrong, and it's our presence that's really, you know, adding to the problem, so shouldn't we just leave? So, let me take the second question first. It is a tremendous mess, and the vast majority of the violence over there is obviously Iraqis killing other Iraqis. Not, in fact, Iraqis killing Americans. I think there's just about, 3,500 Americans? A few over 3,500 Americans who have died. And there's been, you know, tens of thousands of Iraqis who have died. And, unfortunately, if we were to leave, that sort of violence would, in fact, ramp up and be even more vicious than it is now. It's the presence of the Americans and the new Iraqi army that's been created, that is the only thing that is helping to restrain the violence from really getting out of control. And I've talked to a lot of people who feel, and I think rightly so, that if we leave, we will see a Rwanda-style attempt at ethnic cleansing by both sides. So, you know, we could see several million people killed if we just leave. So I understand the frustration we have with this, but again, let me go on to that second question. So how do we know when we have success? Well, we may think that there's no way to achieve some sort of peace over there that's at all acceptable, but the example that I brought up in our first little conversation, I think, is very apt here, and that is the example of Bosnia. There you also had hatreds that went back hundreds of years. You had people who were killing their neighbors that they lived with peacefully for decades. You had, all these sorts of things that just primal, you know, hatreds and fears that just seem there's no way to solve it. But in the end, people got sick of the violence, and there was an outside force that was able to impose a solution and to force especially the Serbians to admit that they had lost and that they could not achieve, you know, return things to the way they were through violence. So I think that the example of Bosnia and other places where outside forces in Africa, in Central America, and elsewhere have been able to impose or help to impose some sort of solution on a civil war give us some hope that there is a solution here as well.
Would you say that we're responsible for unleashing it?
Well, you know, you have to ask yourself what would have happened once Saddam was gone in any case, because these sorts of things are not just created in a day or in a week or in a month. These are the kinds of things that have built up over decades, and it just really takes, you know, kind of the removal of some sort of control, it seems, in order to unleash it. But there is another factor going on here. and that is the positive actions of al-Qaeda, a guy named Zarqawi, who decided that he was purposely going to unleash a civil war that have to be taken into consideration. So, for instance, back in 2004, Zarqawi wrote to al-Qaeda Central and agreed to become one of their kind of franchises if they would allow him to kill Shia and to provoke a civil war in Iraq. So right from the start, he has been blowing up ordinary Shia, killing ordinary Shia, destroying their mosques, doing all sorts of things in order to get them to lose control and go off and start killing Sunnis. And in a tremendous display of self-restraint, the Shia refused to do this for almost 2 years. And then, in as we all know, in February of 2006, that Askariya Mosque was blown up. And many people have accused al-Qaeda and Zarqawi of doing this. And I have to say, this fits his M.O. perfectly. And the result was that the Shia would no longer be restrained, and they started killing their Sunni neighbors. So that's really what set this off. You know, people had been able to live with each other in peace, had been able to do fine, even with the presence of the Americans, for years. And it really took the purposeful efforts of a very evil man, Zarqawi, in order to turn this from, an insurgency aimed against the Americans into this terrible civil war.
Thanks very much, Rodney, for your call. We go next to Jeff from Kewaunee. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, how you doing?
All right, Jeff, how are you?
Good. I've got a question. What would take, why not a different company label us as a terrorist group, since the CIA tries to overthrow governments? We don't accept the, when Hamas wins an election, that's not okay with us. So why, what's to stop them from saying we're a terrorist organization from invading countries? So I'm on the road. I'll be quiet and listen off the air.
All right, Jeff. Thanks for the call. Professor Habeck.
Well, there have been certain nations that have labeled the U.S. as a terrorist nation. I think Chavez, for instance, likes to call the United States a terrorist nation. And I do believe Castro called the United States a terrorist nation. And if you look around the world, there have been various nations that have called the U.S. a terrorist nation. The specific things that you're talking about are spread out over several decades and have to do with the policies of various administrations. Let's take, for instance, the role of the CIA today. The CIA is forbidden by law to do some of the things that you just mentioned because the American people decided that that is not moral and not in our best interest. So the fact that the CIA no longer does that sort of thing, does that mean that we're a terrorist nation today by somebody's definition? I'm not sure. The fact that we won't recognize Hamas, does that make us a terrorist nation or just a nation that has decided that there are specific kinds of regimes that we won't recognize? I mean, there's lots of regimes that we won't recognize. Hamas isn't just sort of joining a list of other nations that we've decided as a people we're not going to recognize. So what's interesting to me is that the UN cannot decide on a definition of terrorism. It can't even write a definition of terrorism that the entire world will agree to. So, one person's terrorist, as everybody says, is another person's freedom fighter. And for many of us, it depends on what your aims are. That determines it, not your tactics.
Tom from Milwaukee. Hi.
Yes, I've heard this thing about the hatred between the Sunnis and the Shiites. But why? Why are they hating each other so badly? And I don't think I've listened to this for about 5 years now, and I still have not heard an explanation as to the root of it all. Does anybody know?
Yeah, there is an explanation, but I'd like to point out again that for hundreds of years, Sunni and Shia were not killing each other. There were resentments and hatreds that were building up sort of underneath the surface that I believe would have been unleashed at some point, but probably not in this way if it hadn't been for the actions of this really evil person, Zarqawi. So let me go back to where those resentments and hatreds came from, though. The split between the Sunni and the Shia occurred very, very shortly after Muhammad's death, when there was a disagreement about who should be the next leader of the Islamic community. So this right from the start was a political as well as a religious disagreement. And from that, that disagreement arose all sorts of differences in worship, differences in ideas about how we should live our lives as Muslims and things like this. And the result was that over time, the Shia became convinced that they needed to sort of withdraw from politics until their perfect leader, the so-called hidden imam, came back and would lead them into victory. And so they became very quietist and really weren't that involved, except in very specific instances in politics or in running countries. And meanwhile, the Sunni, who were the majority, and always have been the majority, ended up running countries, even where they were a minority. So, for instance, Iraq, when it was created with a very large Sunni, or a very large Shia majority, yet the Sunnis, right from the start, have been in charge. And the result, I think, there was there were these ideas about equality and about liberalism and things like this that began to, you know, influence Iraq as much as it did other countries, and especially ideas of nationalism, that we can all be Iraqis together rather than Sunni and Shia or Christian or Yazidi or Turkmen or whoever you were. We're all Iraqis together. And that was very powerful and worked, I think, very well to hold that country together for decades. The one exception, of course, were the Kurds, who always saw themselves as separate and had trouble buying into the notion of being an Iraqi first and Kurdish second. But in any case, this, as I said, worked for a very long time. But the Shia had these little bit of resentments that, or not little bit, but resentments that were building up, because even though there was this talk about equality, in fact, the Shia were not really trusted. And there were these fears on the part of the Sunni Iraqis that, in fact, the Shia are really Iranians who have come over the border, and Persians, and they've come over the border and they want to run our country, which should be Arab and Sunni. So these fears created prejudices and I think resulted in the Shia not being given a fair share, even though the rhetoric of the government was everybody is Iraqi first and then only Sunni and Shia second. And this opened them up, I think, the Shia, that is, to thoughts of, you know, some sort of separate country for ourselves. Maybe we can rebel against this government, and like with the Kurds, perhaps we can, you know, create some sort of separate entity eventually. And when the Americans, when we went in to Iraq during Desert Storm, we, in fact, encouraged the Shia in these hopes. And the result was an uprising against the Sunnis and against Saddam especially. And Saddam was very vicious in putting this down and then spent the next 12 years doing one of his major policies was to exclude the Shia from any positions of power, to make sure that his base amongst the Sunnis was secure and to depend almost solely on Sunni Arabs for his support and legitimacy. And so for 12 years, the Shia were just kept in really absolute poverty and out of any sort of government positions where they could do anything. And over time, this again created all sorts of resentments and hatreds. And meanwhile, he, by the way, was reinforcing these notions that the Sunnis had, that the Shia are a bunch of Iranians, that they're really Persians who want to run your country and make you into Persians instead of true Arabs. And he really inflamed this hatred between the two groups, that somebody like Zarqawi could then take advantage of, and through violence push these two groups, who, as I said, lived for hundreds of years in peace, push them into violence against each other.
Mm-hmm. So it all goes back to Muhammad, then, really.
Well, after Muhammad, because it was Muhammad's death that set off this kind of power struggle between the majority that were the Sunnis and the minority that became the Shia.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Tom, for your call. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. Our guest this hour is Professor Mary Habeck. associate professor of strategic studies at Johns Hopkins University, author of Knowing the Enemy, Jihadist Ideology and the War on Terror. We have a lot of issues we're discussing in the hour, the Yazidi bombings, the horrendous bombings, probably one of the worst attacks in more than 4 years of war. The reasons for that, we'll be looking at labeling Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps as a foreign terrorist organization. We are talking about Zarqawi and the insurgency and how much trouble he's been stirring up. We're looking at the surge, a number of different issues on the table this hour. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, some really interesting products that promote change. And we'll be talking about that with the founders of buychange.com. You may want to look it up on the internet before we talk about it on the air. Our guests believe that the ultimate force for sustainable positive change is business. And if we use our dollars and do so in an intentional fashion, we can make the world a better place. Professor Mary Habeck is here now, Associate Professor of Strategic Studies at Johns Hopkins University, and our phone number is 800-486-8655. If you're in Milwaukee, it's 227-2050. Habu from Madison is next. Hi, Habu.
Yes, good morning to both of you. I have to take exception to what your guest said about when the question was posed by the host, and correctly so, she mentioned that this was this whole anarchy was prompted by the U.S. invasion of Iraq, and that's of course correct. To which the guest answered that well, this was only a matter of time, implying that after Saddam Hussein had gone would have gone, then that would have unleashed this. There's nothing further from the truth, and that's, of course, pure speculation. For one thing, the Saddam was known for having such a tight security apparatus, the Mukhabarat, and to say then, oh, well, when he's gone, this thing is going to be unleashed. And it seems like in the Western, the talking heads in the Western press are the ones who keep emphasizing the Sunni-Shia divide. They live in other countries, and of course, yes, there is a power imbalance, but they live in other countries, and we don't see this kind of killing. And now, of course, it's gone to another level, and there's no telling who is doing what. Anyway, that's my aside. But my question is this. I personally do not like the interference of other people coming into Iraq and just exacerbating the situation, such as the Saudi jihadis, and of course there are Iranian agents in Iraq. But both these peoples have more right to be on Middle Eastern soil than do the Americans.
Professor Habeck.
Yeah, can I ask if there's a question there?
I don't know that I have a question, but to mention that these people have more of a right to be there and for the United States to somehow make these people illegal or put the terrorist label so that we don't talk to them till kingdom come is somewhat ridiculous.
Hmm. Yeah, I guess I go back to the whole problem of the Civil War. So, for instance, the Shia uprising against Saddam, back in 1991, encouraged by the Americans, show that there was already these kinds of resentments and desires for some sort of liberation. I'm not saying, you know, where that would have headed to, but some sort of different kind of life amongst the Shia already. And I agree with you that the American presence there certainly speeded things up in that regard. They definitely wanted to have those elections so that they could vote and show that they were the majority and take charge of Iraqi affairs for the first time. That definitely is true. But the kind of violence that we saw and have seen over the past year and a half really, really, really was set off by the actions of one particular group of people who purposely went around killing innocent women and children and men in order to provoke this kind of civil war. So I think that the kind, you know, what we're seeing now wouldn't have happened if the Americans had not gone in and if you hadn't had Zarqawi. What you would have had without the Americans And without Zarqawi, if Saddam had simply been deposed, you would have had another uprising by the Shia. And I cannot tell you if it would have succeeded or failed, but they would have attempted, as the Kurds did multiple times, to fight for their freedom. And what that would have led to, in my opinion, eventually was some sort of struggle between the Sunni and the Shia, regardless of whether the Americans had gotten involved or not. But you're right, this kind of violence that we're seeing, this kind of real visceral hatred, took years of patient and terrible work by a group of people, purposely killing in order to provoke violence. So, I have to say that the American presence alone wouldn't have set this off if it hadn't been for the work of Zarqawi at all. As for the presence of other groups in this country, we could say that they have more right to be there, but you really have to ask yourself, are they there working for the betterment of Iraq as a whole? Are they there working for the betterment of their own countries and their own countries' positions? In other words, are they honest brokers in this civil war that's brewing or that has broken out in this country? Or are they there simply trying to better their own country's national interest? Now, you could say, okay, the U.S. is trying to do the same thing, but Iraqis as a whole understand that the Americans, and believe, and this is something that has taken years, by the way, in order to work out, that the Americans really are better brokers than the Saudis or the Iranians are. And you can tell this by the relationship that the Americans have with the government there and with the Sunni groups there versus the relationship those same people have with Iran or Saudi Arabia or Syria or any other of their neighbors, all of whom the Iraqi government views with distrust and dislike.
Yeah, but you also have to ask, is there an Iraqi government right now? I mean, what are we talking about here? There's hardly a government.
Yeah.
So who are we getting along with?
This is a big problem. I think this is actually, and I'm glad you brought it up, none of your callers have, but this is actually the biggest problem that we're facing there. It's not so much the violence, which, is horrific. I don't want to minimize that in any way. But the bigger problem in any insurgency is finding a political solution to a war. And the political solution here looked pretty obvious a year and a half ago. You have a government that's been elected by the people, a free election for the first time in this country's history, well, first time in a very long time in this country's history. And so the political solution looked like, a done deal. But now the Maliki government and his cabinet in particular seem like they're collapsing. And, that's a much bigger problem than the military solution. Military problem.
Thanks, Habu, very much for your call. Let's go next to Rob from Milwaukee. Hi, Rob.
Hi.
Hi.
My question for your guest is about the idea of naming the Iranian National Guard as a terrorist organization as sort of a way to force them into talks. I just don't understand the logic of that, especially when you look at after 9/11, Iran wanted to convene a summit with the United States to talk about international terrorism and how they can work to solve it together. And the Bush administration's response was to send George Bush out and give a speech and put Iran on the axis of evil. And now we're going to call them a terrorist organization? I don't see how antagonizing them constantly like this is productive in any way. I guess I'd like to ask your guest how it could be productive to call them a terrorist organization.
I'm not privy to, Bush administration's workings or their views of this particular move. So I am speculating when I make these sorts of assertions, and speculating from some knowledge. But I haven't been present at the meetings in which these things were decided. So please don't take this as this is what the Bush administration is really up to. I'm simply saying that if you want to bring somebody whose government you do not trust, an entire regime, in fact, whose motives you have good reason not to trust, to some sort of realization that their policies are not working, there's a couple ways you can do it. One is to do it through negotiations, and another way is to do it through some sort of coercive action. But you can do both at the same time as well in support of each other, so coercive action in order to get some sort of negotiation. And my sense is that the Bush administration has probably been doing some sort of backdoor talks with folks in the Iranian government and came to the conclusion that these guys can't be trusted because they'll, you know, I've heard, you know, news reports where they say one thing and then the next day there's attacks and they're using Iranian weapons in order to kill Americans. So there's probably certain red lines, like killing Americans, that we're not willing to reward with negotiations. So maybe this is a way of saying, if you don't cut out killing Americans, you're never going to get us to any negotiating table. But this is me speculating.
Yeah, thanks, Rob, for your call. Let's go to Saeed next from Green Bay. Hi.
Yes, good morning, Kathleen, and good morning, Mary. Thank you very much for taking my call. I am listening in absolute bewilderment as I listen to the confusion that underlies the elevation of the theocratic thugs in Iran to the same moral equivalency as what we are trying to accomplish in Iraq. All you have to do is ask yourself, what happens to the Iraqi people if Americans succeed? And what happens to them if Iranians succeed? If Americans succeed, the Iraqi people can look forward to liberty. If Iranians succeed, the Iraqi people can look forward to the same subjugation and theocratic rule that the Iranian people have been subjected to. But I'm calling to comment about the designation of the Iranian Revolutionary Guards as a terrorist organization. This is a long-awaited-for accomplishment from the standpoint of the 7 million Iranians who live outside of Iran. We have watched in absolute disbelief as this organization, and particularly the Quds force of this organization, has assassinated our poets, our writers, our political leaders, our opinion makers, anyone who has the potential to become the focus of a strong opposition is assassinated by this organization outside of Iran. In France, France has essentially been the killing ground of Iranian dissidents in the last 20 years. The European governments are not only slow to pursue, they're slow to prosecute to the extent that one can have to conclude that they somehow are uninterested in confronting this entity. And yeah, my hat is off to the United States for designating this organization for what it is. They are responsible for over 90% of terrorist activities worldwide in the last two decades.
Professor Habeck.
Yes, you know, this is very quickly. Thank you so much for bringing this up. I've made my comments about the Quds Force very Iraq-centric and very American-centric. But you do have to take a little bit of a bigger vision here. They are active, in fact, worldwide in South America and Europe, as you mentioned, throughout the Middle East, and have carried out attacks that have been drawn directly back to them. And, of course, this is not just some sort of rogue Iranian group. This is an integral part of the Iranian regime. So this is something that they are controlling and that they are carrying out as part of their purposeful plan. So I think that you're right. This is something that has been fought over for years. But the question is, why now? And that's, I think, what I was attempting to answer with my response.
Thanks so much for the call. We have time for maybe one more phone call, maybe two. Jerry from Waterford, hi.
Hi, thank you very much for taking my call. My question is that about a month and a half ago, I heard on C-SPAN the ambassador from Iraq to the United States state that none of the suicide bombers have been Iraqi. They have all been from foreign countries, and the majority of which were from Europe. And my question is that factual? And if that's factual, are we in a position of, after the situation is no longer occurring over there, that these same suicide bombers could be directed towards the United States?
Yeah, I think this is a real fear that people have. You're right. The vast majority, although I wouldn't say all, but the vast majority of the suicide bombings that are carried out in Iraq are carried out by foreigners of one sort or another. I don't believe most of them are from Europe. I think most of them are actually from Saudi Arabia and elsewhere in the Middle East. But there are real fears on the part of a lot of security organizations that these sorts of tactics could be used in Europe or the United States. There was a recent report, I'm sure you've seen it, that came out with Homeland Security saying that they believe there are something like two dozen cells in the United States that are capable of carrying out terrorist actions. Now, that doesn't mean that they know that these guys are planning on carrying out terrorist attacks, but that they have the capability to do this sort of thing. This is actually a minor problem if you compare it with what's going on in Britain. Britain has 30 groups that have active plots going on. So these are cells that have active plans to carry out attacks inside Britain, unlike in the United States where they just have the capability. These are guys that are actually planning on doing it. And I think the last number I saw was 3,000 of their citizens under surveillance for suspicion of being involved wanting to be involved in terrorism.
Thanks so much for the call. We are out of time. Thank you, Professor Habeck, for being with us.
My pleasure.
Our guest, Professor Mary Habeck, Associate Professor of Strategic Studies at Johns Hopkins University and author of Knowing the Enemy, Jihadist Ideology and the War on Terror, here to discuss all kinds of areas with us, the attacks, the Yazidi bombings, and also looking at Iran and labeling the Revolutionary Guard Corps as a foreign terrorist organization. Is the surge working? What's happening with the Iraqi government, etc.? Thanks to Rita Thomas for producing this hour. Thanks, Rita. John Treader, our on-air producer here in Milwaukee. We thank John very much as well. And thanks, everybody, for all of your interesting phone calls and informed phone calls, as always. You're just a very good audience. We have news coming up from National Public Radio, and we'll return with more Thursday conversation. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.